At dinner, Rabbi Wein told me that he recently spoke in Miami together with Rabbi Pesach Krohn. And Rabbi Krohn is known for his stories. And he felt that after speaking with Rabbi Krohn, you have nothing left to say story-wise. I told him, now you know how I feel when I have to speak on the same program with you. So I'm going to start with a story I heard from Rabbi Wein. That I think pretty much capsulizes how I feel. I was very much honored and very happy to have been invited to come here for a second time. But then it reminded me of the story that I did hear of the Chazan who gave a performance, and when he finished his last number, the people begged for an encore. So he sang the number again. And when he finished it, they begged for another encore. He sang it again. After 10 times of this, he said, I am flattered that you keep wanting to hear this song over and over again, but how many times? And some from the back got up and said, until you do it right. So I hope this time I'll do it right, and you can invite me for other occasions. I have a feeling that I am here not only because of my long relationship with Rabbi Wein. He failed to mention that we don't go back only as friends. He's a Rebbe of mine from way back in Miami in the Misifta, and I am very, very proud to be able to say that. But maybe I've gotten back at him. His wife is a Talmidah of mine, who comes to my shiurim on Mondays religiously. So I'm very proud of that also. In any case, the topic that I was given is educating children in a secular world, isolation, insulation, or exposure. By the time I finish, I will tell you why I think the title is not a proper one. And at the end, I'll tell you what the title should have been. But we'll leave that for the end. I think that it would be proper first to discuss the problem. Why is it difficult to raise children in a secular world? Aren't we strong enough in our belief, in our principles, to withstand all of the influences of a secular society, of the society around us? The Rambam tells us not like that. The Rambam says, Derech Briyaso Shel Adam, by man's very nature, he is a creature who is influenced by his surroundings. It's part of the very nature of man. Very interesting sidelight. How did the Rambam know that? He knew it from his medical background. How did he know that man, by his nature, is influenced by, please, the baby does not bother me at all. Really, I would hate, the Gemara says that the world exists on the babble of little children. I haven't found yet a Gemara that says the world exists on my babble. I would not, after 120 years, want to have to answer the question why I took precedence over a little baby. And as long as the crying is not in my home at night, it's fine. So please, feel comfortable to stay here. Where did the Rambam know that by one's very nature, it's part of the natural makeup of human beings? We're made to be influenced by our surroundings. The Migdal Oz, one of the commentaries on the Rambam, mentions what seems on the surface to be an enigma, a cryptic source for this Rambam. The source, he says, is the following Gemara, which you are all familiar with, if not as a Gemara, but as a song. Ketzad Meragdin Lefnei Hakal. How do you dance? Rashi says the main thing is not the steps. The Gemara is not going to teach you how to dance. But when you're dancing, what do you say to the Kala? What do you say in praise of the Kala that the Chassan should feel that that he made a good choice? Beishamai, who we don't paskin like, so don't get scared. Beishamai says that you say Kala Kemoshehi, which has three explanations. The most extreme explanation of Beis Shammai is that you have to say the truth. In other words, If you think the Kala is a Miyasa Machshefa who has no character, and the Chassan says, no, what do you think of my bride? You have to say, I think she's a Miyasa Machshefa with no character. You don't have to go to that wedding. You can stay by the smorgasbord. You can keep your mouth full. But if you say something, it has to be the truth. That's the most extreme opinion in Beis Shammai. A more moderate opinion in Beis Shammai is that you find something nice about the Kala. Okay, you think she's a Miyasa Machshefa without any character. If the Chassan says, what do you think about my Kala? You say, I think her shoes fit perfectly. You said the truth. You said something nice. You didn't say a lie. The most moderate opinion of Beis Shammai is, you say those words. The Kala is as she is. The Chassan hears what he wants to hear. You meant what you meant to say. Nobody is harmed. You didn't say any lies. That's Beis Shammai. Beis Hillel says, you say, Kala no v'chasuda. The Kala is beautiful and charming. So Beis Shammai asked Beis Hillel, and what if she's not beautiful and charming? And the Torah said, Midvar Sheker Tirchof, you're supposed to stay far away from lies. How could you justify lying? So Beis Hillel answers with a question. He doesn't answer the question. He answers another question. What if somebody went to the market and bought a lemon, something really, really bad? In Eretz Yisrael, I like to give the example, sometimes in Geula, they have artists who set up their wares on the corner. These horrendous paintings that you would have doubts of hanging it with the painted sign towards the wall. Marked down always. 100 shekel with a big X down to 50. Actually started from zero, went up to 50. And a poor, unsuspecting husband like myself wants to buy his wife something nice, sees these beautiful paintings, buys it, and he stops a friend on the street and says, "No, what do you think?" Right? You'll never be able to return it because the people don't stay more than 10 minutes on the same corner. They know already what's going to be. So what do you tell the guy? You bought a lemon, right? It's the most horrendous picture I've ever seen. Be nice, be sociable. It's nice. What can he do anyway? He can't return it. There's nothing he can do. He's finished. His wife will tell him what the painting looks like. You don't have to tell him. So someone buys something like that and he can't return, there's nothing he can do, what should you do? Praise it or give it a critique? Obviously you should praise it. So too, from here the rabbi said, this is the finish of that Gemara, La'olam tehedaito shel adam u'revis imhabriyas, which loosely translated is, a person should be sociable. Be mixed in with other people, don't be antisocial, be a nice guy. What are you going to gain by telling the truth sometimes? A little white lie never hurt. That is the Gemara. Says the Migdal Oz, this is the source where the Rambam learned that people by their very nature are influenced by their surroundings. Where did he find it then? So I was thinking that that last statement is read the wrong way. The Migdal Oz learned that last statement a different way. La'olam tehedaito shel adam u'revis im habriyus is not a command that you should be sociable. It's a statement of fact. A person's mind is always mixed in with other people's minds. And you are by nature influenced by what other people think. And therefore, if that chassan thinks that this kala is a kala no v'chasuda, and he obviously does think that she is a beautiful and charming kala, he wouldn't have married her otherwise, then somewhere in your mind, it's made an impression on you. And even though consciously you don't think like that, but there's a place in your mind that you've been influenced by his opinion where it's not a lie anymore to say Kala no v'chasuda. Mikan omru chachamim, from here the rabbis learn that a person's mind will always be mixed in with other people's minds. You can't escape it. You have to be influenced. It's part of nature. How does that work? Does that mean that if you move next door to a thief, in a day or two, you'll also be a thief? Obviously not. The nature of that influence is very subtle, very gradual, and has many faces to it. Briefly, I'd like to mention some of them. And after we understand very clearly how potent environmental influence is, what the Bali Musar call hashpas hasviva, the influence of the environment, then we'll understand what the problem is and why it's hard to raise children or raise anyone or raise yourself in a secular society where the environmental influences are so potent and so strong and so natural. First way that the environment influences a person is by putting yourself in a situation where you could be influenced. Nothing more, even if the influence never happens. There's a very, very interesting Michtav Meliyahu from Rabbi Dessler. It's a very difficult medrash. The medrash says, Vayoel Moshe Loshevet Hatzoish, when Moshe Rabbeinu decided to get married and live with his father-in-law Yisro, so the Torah uses a strange language, a strange phrase, Vayoel Moshe. Moshe began to live with Yisro. And the Medrash comments on that, Ein Vayoel El Eloshin Shvua. Moshe Rabbeinu took an oath when he agreed to live with Yisro, he took an oath that the first child he would have would be dedicated to idolatry. Yeah, Moshe Rabbeinu took an oath that the first child that he would have, firstborn, would be dedicated to idolatry. That's Moshe Rabbeinu. His first child is giving over to be an idolater. Says the Michtav Meliyahu, what it means is the following. Whenever the rabbis say that someone took an oath, it doesn't mean they said, I swear such and such. An oath is just an expression of commitment, that you're really committed to something. When Moshe Rabbeinu agreed to live with Yisro, he knew what the options were. He knew what the possibilities were. He knew that perhaps he was strong enough to withstand the influence of a family, of a Yisro, who at that time was not yet a believer in God. He was still experimenting and investigating all the idolatries of the world. Moshe perhaps thought of on himself that I can withstand the pressures of this environment. But my children most certainly are prey to those influences. And therefore he knew it wouldn't happen. He hoped that he would influence his child more than his father-in-law would influence him. But he knew that the possibility existed that Yisro would influence this child. And therefore he agreed to enter into such a situation where the possibility existed that his child could be influenced to idolatry. It's as if he made a vow. It's as if he committed himself that even if that comes out, I'm willing to accept that. Otherwise, he wouldn't have put himself into the situation. So merely putting oneself into a situation where it's possible that one will be influenced in a negative way is in itself the beginning of the influence, in itself something negative. Goes beyond that. First chapter in Tehillim, Ashrei ho'ish, asher lo holach ba'atzas reshoyim, fortunate is a person who hasn't walked with the wicked, uvederech hatoyim lo omad, and he hasn't stood with those who are sinners, uvamoshav leitzim lo yoshav, and he hasn't sat with scoffers. Says the Medrash, kivin shoholach sofo lamot, v'kivin shoomad sofo leishe. It doesn't happen overnight. But if you walk with sinners, eventually you'll stand still and listen to what they have to say. And if you stand still, eventually you'll sit down. It's a very slow, subtle process that wears away at a person year after year, month after month. You're not going to see the results intensely, quickly, but they wear away, they erode on a person, and they happen very, very slowly, level by level. Thirdly, they affect a person's sensitivity. Even if you never change, you never see any concrete evidence that you've been influenced, you've still been influenced. Give me an example. The rabbis question the fact that there were six cities of refuge in Eretz Israel for people who killed unintentionally to run away to and to be protected from the avengers of the blood of the murdered victim. Gol Adam. There were six cities of refuge, three of them in Eretz Yisrael proper, and three of them in Eber HaYarden in Transjordan. And the rabbis questioned that it wasn't proportionate, There were 9.5 tribes in Eretz Yisrael proper, and for them, there were 3 cities of refuge. There were only 2.5 tribes in Transjordan, and they also got 3 cities of refuge. The Gemara answers, Begilad Shchichei Rotzchi. In Gilad, in Transjordan, there happened to be groups, marauding murderers, who went around killing people. And therefore, they needed more cities of refuge. So all of the commentaries ask the same question. Cities of refuge were only necessary for people who killed unintentionally. Intentional murders didn't go to a city of refuge. They were executed. So why would they need more cities of refuge if there were bands of marauding murderers in Gilad? They didn't go to cities of refuge. The Maharal Miprag says the reason is because murder, even unintentional murder, is much more difficult to happen in a place where people appreciate life, in a place where murder is something that is unheard of. People are sensitive to the value of life. They're very careful with human life, and they don't kill people even unintentionally. They're not careless. Careless homicide, unintentional, but careless doesn't happen when people are sensitized to the value of human life. If you live in a society where you never see a murder, you never hear of a murder, then human life is very dear to you. But if you live in a society, as we do, where every day you open the newspaper, and this one was murdered, and 10 people over here were killed by terrorists, and this tragedy and that tragedy, and you eat your breakfast and dunk your donut and read of all these tragedies and all these terrible murders, eventually become desensitized to the value of life. You're never going to become a murderer. You're not going to go out and kill somebody. But you're desensitized to the value of life, and you're more prone to be careless in killing somebody else unintentionally. So in a desensitized society, even if it never brings you to actually do the things that are being done around you, but it desensitizes you to the importance and the severity of what's going around. The last idea is connected to this, how a person is influenced, even if in a concrete way he'll never do what the society around him is doing, it still affects him. The Michtam Eliyahu explains that when it comes to free choice, there are 3 areas that are relevant to a person's free choice. It's like a war. In a war, you have the area that you conquered, that's your territory. You have the area that the enemy has conquered, that's his territory. And then you have the no man's land in between these 2 territories, and that's where the war is being fought. The war is not being fought on the enemy's land, it's not being fought on your land, it's being fought on the land that has not yet been claimed by either side. So too when it comes to free choice, all of us have areas that we have conquered for the good, habitual. If you've been a Shomer Shabbos, even for a few years, you've been a Shomer Shabbos your whole life, most certainly, you don't wake up Shabbos morning and say, should I drive to Shul this Shabbos or walk? It's automatic. It's habitual. It's not a question of, should I do this, shouldn't I do it? You have a fight between the evil inclination and the good inclination. It's a habit. It's conquered already for the good. On the other hand, we have areas, unfortunately, that are conquered already for the bad, that we're in the habit of doing. Sometimes, unfortunately, someone tells you some juicy gossip. You don't have a question. Should I listen? Shouldn't I listen? Should I say it over or not? It's habitual. Of course you're going to say it over. It's not a question. There's a fight even going on. The Yetzer Hara already has conquered that for the bad. Where is there free choice? In that middle ground. Things that have not yet become a habit for the good. Things that have not yet become a habit for the bad. Your evil inclination says, do what's wrong. Your good inclination says, do what's right. And there's a battle. There you have to make a choice. Where that bouncing ball of free choice is, where is the no man's land? How much area is conquered for the good, and how much for the bad, and how far away are you from that middle point also makes a significant difference. There are certain mitzvahs in the Torah or prohibitions in the Torah that we couldn't fathom anyone ever doing. They're beyond our comprehension that anyone ever did that or could possibly do it. An example. The prohibition of against burning your child, roasting your child, right, to Molech. Right, you should take a child, pass him between two fires, and slowly barbecue the child over the fires. Okay. Maybe the people have considered that sometimes, doing that to their children, but under normal circumstances, it's beyond the pale of possibility even. It's not just a question, well, look, I'm a religious person, I wouldn't do that. It's beyond the realm of possibility. But imagine if you lived in a society where all around you, you saw people sacrificing their children to their gods. That doesn't mean that you're ever going to do it, but it already becomes within the realm of possibility. It's something that's much closer to no man's land than it was when you never experienced such a thing and it was beyond the realm of possibility. Now it's within the realm of possibility, it's just that I would never do it. By habit, I don't do such things. But it's one step closer to the no man's land. That in itself is an influence. So therefore, it's impossible to say, I am strong, my children are strong, my home is strong, and I can expose my children to anything, myself to anything, and we won't be influenced. It's like saying I can put my hand in the fire and I won't be burnt. It's impossible. By the very nature of this world, you put your hand into fire unprotected, you get burnt. If you put yourself in a situation where you are open to the influences, negative influences, then you by nature are going to be affected. It's impossible, impossible not to be affected. And therefore the Rambam says that a person should always strive to live in an environment that is positive and run away from a bad environment. And if you know that all the places around have bad environments, then you should go and move to another country. And if you know that all the countries around have bad environments, like the Rambam says, like in our time, in his time, then you should go live out in the desert, alone. I remember my Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Gifter, he should be well, in the 60s, once spoke about this topic. And he said, in the Rambam's time, you could run to the desert. Today, the hippies are in the desert. You can't even run into the desert. So what do? Should we be isolationists? Isolate ourselves from society, go find a cave, and live totally isolated? Pretty much, it's impossible. Right? And the truth is that I feel a little unqualified to speak about this topic, even though I was brought up in Miami Beach, which is not exactly isolated from a secular society. I was just back there and remembered very, very clearly how much isolated it is. But I live now in Moshav Matityahu, which for many years was on a lone mountaintop, surrounded by other lone mountaintops, with 60 religious families, and pretty much separated from the rest of the world. To show you how isolated it was, when I first came to Matityahu, there were children who were brought up, who grew up in Matityahu, in the elementary school. And I took them on a trip to Kever Rachel, because at that time, it must have been about 14, 15 years ago, there was a threat of war from Syria. So I took these children to Kever Rachel, that we should say Tehillim and Daven, that we should be protected. So I spoke to these children, they were 9, 10, 11 years old, and I said to them that, you know, that there is a threat of war with Syria, and we have to daven very well that the Rabbanu should protect us. And one little boy raised his hand, he said, you mean Syria has declared war on Matityahu? That was the extent of his knowledge of what there existed in the world. It was Matityahu and Syria, and that was it. Even more so, about 13, 14 years ago, I had the opportunity to be back in the States this time of year. And I came with another young men from Matityahu, and he had a boy who was born on the Moshav. He must have been also 8, 9, 10 years old. And he told him, you're very fortunate that I'm going to America this time of year. because the day after Christmas, there are toy sales, and I will find you some real mitzvahs. And the boy looked at him and said, what is Christmas? Can you imagine that here? I find myself humming jingle bells in the stores, right? Knowing what it is, let alone not knowing. I had in Tells, there was a Ger Tzedek. I had a very, very fine Talmud Chacham who used to sit right in front of one of the older Rosh Hashivas. And everybody hums something when they learn. So he also hummed, but he hummed something from his previous background. He used to hum Davy Crockett. Coming from Miami, I knew what he was humming. Most of the guys there had absolutely no idea. They thought it was some new Hasidish tune. Every day he would learn to na 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 na. One day I passed by the Rosh Yeshiva, a Litvish Elter Yid, and I hear him learning, humming to himself, na 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 na, not knowing what he was doing. So you can be influenced even not knowing, but you can be influenced knowing too. One more example of why I just feel perhaps not the one to speak about this topic. My wife bought, there was a sale in the supermarkets in Eretz Israel a few years ago. They brought in products from America with hechsherim that you couldn't get in Eretz Israel. So my wife bought home a treat, Quaker Oats cereal. I come home from davening, and my 7-8-year-old daughter comes to the door, ecstatic. She says, Tati, Tati, you have to see what Mommy bought. I said, what? She bought cereal from America with a picture of the Kalev Rebbe on it. Looking at the picture of that Quaker, Taka looks like the Kalev Rebbe. Okay, so that is Moshav Matityahu. Perhaps if everybody lived in Moshav Matityahu, we could have an isolationist approach to raising children. But even in Matityahu today, it doesn't work. Nowhere in the world can you isolate yourself totally from the influences of the society around you. So that's not the answer. Isolation is definitely not a practical, possible solution. So what is the solution? How do you avoid this natural influence which hits you subtly, gradually? It's a very interesting Meiri. The Meiri quotes the philosophers, and he says the following. The evil influences of this world are compared to a sea, and the way to escape them is like a boat. And when I first saw that quote, there was something wrong here. You can never escape the sea in a boat. A boat can only exist on the sea. What it should have said was, the evil influences in this world are like the sea, and the way to escape them is like an amphibious craft that can get out of the sea and go on the dry land. Doesn't say that. Says that the way to escape it is like a boat. What does that imply? That it is impossible to escape evil influences in this world by running away from them. Wherever you go, Yerushalayim Yir HaKodesh, there are going to be evil influences. Just to remind you, Sodom and Amorah were not in Miami Beach. They were in Eretz Israel. So wherever you go, you can't escape, you can't isolate yourself from negative influences. They're always going to be there. If they're not there, they're down the block. So what can you do? You can build around yourself a boat and insulate yourself. That's the most you can do. To see that at least, partially, as much as possible, those waters do not penetrate the insulation that is represented by this boat. And that is exactly what Yosef HaTzadik intimated to his father and his brothers when he described how they came to Egypt. He tells his brothers, I'm going to tell Paro, Achai ubeisavi asher be'eretz Kanaan bo elai. For anyone who knows Hebrew, those words don't make any sense. They're translated into English, My father, my brothers, and my father's household have come to me from the land of Canaan. That's what it should have said, but it's not what it says in the Hebrew. It should have said, Achayu Beis Avdi Asher Mei Eretz Canaan Bo Eilad. My family who were in the land of Canaan have come here. What it does say is, Achayu Beis Avdi Asher Bi Eretz Canaan. My father's household who are in the land of Canaan have come here. How could they have come here if they're in the land of Canaan? Either they're there or they're here. The answer is that Yosef intimated that the only way to survive in Mitzrayim is to be there at the same time in Eretz Yisrael. To take the environment of Eretz Yisrael, of Eretz Canaan, and transpose it into Egypt, insulated. I always like to compare it to the artist's conception of a moon colony. You want to establish a colony on the moon, you can't just open shop. You have to somehow control the atmosphere, the environment, that it should be friendly to earthlings. So what the artist's conception of a moon colony is a colony that is separated by a bubble, big plastic bubble which has its own atmosphere, its own living conditions. It's on the moon, but it's not with the moon. It's amongst what's there, but it's its own insulated colony. That's how a Jew has to live in Golus. He has to create his own environment with his own standards and values, like a little bubble, living amongst but not living with, leaving that colony to go out and deal with the world around him, but knowing that that's not where he's living within that bubble. We'll discuss in a few minutes how that's possible. But this, I think, sheds light on a very difficult Mishnah in Pirkei Avos and a very important lesson for communities, for communal leaders and for people who live in communities, which pretty much covers everybody. The Mishnah says like this, Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma was once walking along the way, and he met someone who obviously was a very fine person, and he said to him, Shalom Alecha Rebbe, gave him a very honorable hello, and he answered him, Shalom Aleichem. And the man said to him, Rebbe, where do you come from? He said, I come from a city of Torah scholars, city with many fine yeshivas, kolulim. The man said, that's very nice, but I come from a city where there's no Torah at all, nothing. Not a day school, not a yeshiva, not one Torah scholar. He said, however, we do have one thing in our community, plenty of money. So how would you like to come and live in our community, and we will give you an unlimited budget, gold, silver, precious gems, whatever you want, unlimited. Just come and live in our community. We should be able to have a Torah scholar in our community. Now, I don't know about you, but if someone offered me that possibility, okay, unlimited budget, so what would I do? What would be the proper thing to do? Of course, I'm coming tomorrow. Not only am I coming, unlimited budget. I'm bringing 20 families with me. We're going to start a kollel, a yeshiva, two butcher shops. Unlimited funds. You start a new Torah. How did every Torah community in the world ever get started? B'nai Brak, Torah community. It was not a Torah community when the Chazon Ish came there. Yerushalayim was the Torah community. B'nai Brak was on the border. It was a border community. No Torah was there. The Ponevish Rav, the Chazon Ish, went into a desert and they built the Torah community. And they didn't have unlimited funds. They didn't have an unlimited budget. So, if I was Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma, he would ask me what should his answer have been. The answer, l'chora, should have been, sure, just show me where to sign. Right, I'm bringing a ready-made Torah community, transplanting it in your community, building a new Torah community. Whether it be also be Kishma telling, you can give me all the money in the world and any Dor El Abamakam Torah, which usually is translated. I will stay in my Torah environment and I will never leave it, never go move to your city. Doesn't seem right. So I was thinking that that's not what Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma answered. It's not what he said. Yossi ben Kisma was troubled by the invitation, because there's an extra word in the invitation. The invitation was, Ritzoncha shetodur imanu b'mkomenu. Would you like to live with us in our place? He could have said, would you like to live with us in our place? Obviously, it's with us. Or he could have said, would you like to live with us? Obviously, in our place. Why the double, live with us in our place? Rabbi Yossi ben Kithma heard from that the invitation was, come and live shoulder to shoulder with us. We'll be buddy-buddy. You'll influence us, we'll influence you, and you know what would happen then? Everybody would reach the lowest common denominator. Rav Yossi ben Kishma said, I'll come to your place, but don't make the mistake to think that I'll live with you in your place. I will live in your place, but in any door of a makom Torah. I will create a makom Torah, that little bubble within your place, to give you something to look up to give you something to aspire to, that I will have an influence on you, but you won't have an influence on me. At least not for the negative things. I will live in my Makom Torah transposed amongst you, but not shoulder to shoulder, not with you. And that's the only way a yeshiva, a Makom Torah can exist and create, if it's amongst but not with. Friendly, open, reaching out, but reaching out from a bubble of Torah that gives people something to look up to. Not reaching out from a situation of not only being amongst, but being with. This applies to everything. The Levim, who were the people who were supposed to influence and teach the Jewish people, were separated to a certain degree, insulated from the rest of the Jewish people. Not because the Jewish people were bad, chas v'shalom. They were precious, but God wanted them to have something to look up to, something more that they could aspire to. And unless they were somewhat insulated and separated, that never would happen. And that, in truth, is the purpose of Eretz Yisrael. We have a place that ideally all Jews should be. When Mashiach will come, all Jews will be in Eretz Yisrael, insulated, not isolated. We have to be a Or La'amim. We have to be a light to the nations of the world. We have to deal with every nation. We have to conduct business with them. We have to deal with them on many, many levels. But we need a place that is our society, where every aspect of society is sanctified and is lived in a Jewish way, not in a secular way. And when you have that insulated environment, that little bubble amongst the rest of the world, you're living amongst the world, you're dealing with the world, but you're not with them, you're amongst them. Then you have the chance of surviving by insulation. You have that boat that is on the sea, but the sea can't penetrate the boat. That is the ideal. Every aspect of human endeavor, which we share with the nations of the world, economic endeavor, social endeavor, married life, politics, everything, we have our way of doing it. We have a Torah sanctified way, and the rest of the nations have a secular way. And when we create that boat, that bubble of Torah living, then we can deal, we can go off the boat sometimes. But we know that the place where we exist is that boat. And the truth is that we are slowly reaching that goal, at least in one area. Israeli political life, right, brings the nations of the world to a recognition of godliness. Right? What do the nations of the world say when they hear of Israeli politics? Oh my God. So we are slowly reaching that goal of being a light unto the nations of the world and reminding them that there's a God in the world. In that respect, the rabbis tell us that we are compared to oil and the nations of the world to water. Oil and water, by their very nature, can't mix. What is the ideal? That the oil should float on top of the water, separated by a little surface tension. As long as the oil floats on the water and there's that small separation, that insulation, not isolation, the oil is right there on top of the water, but it's insulated, then the oil protects the water and the water supports the oil. But if you try to shake the oil into the water, that it's not only amongst, but with, then eventually the water pressure pushes the oil to the surface, and that is the safety valve which God created to avoid assimilation. As Reb Chaim Volozhiner says, the Jew has only two choices. Either we make Kiddush or the goyim make havdalah. Either we sanctify ourselves and separate and insulate ourselves from the negative influences of a secular world, or eventually the goyim will separate us and remind us that we can't live with them. At most, we can live amongst them. And even that, they won't accept. And therefore, the title, I think, should have been, and now I'll address, practically speaking, so how do you raise your children and accomplish this insulation, not isolation? And we'll speak about exposure also. The title should have been, Raising a Child in a Secular World, Isolation, Insulation, and Exposure, because you need all three of them. You can't have one of the three. All three are necessary under different circumstances. There are situations where exposure is extremely important. You have a child that you can isolate from negative influences his entire life. He will never have to ever come in contact with those negative influences, then the best way to deal with it is isolation. Don't expose that child to these negative influences if he's never going to have to be exposed to them in real life. Some people feel that educating your child about all the evils that exist in the world is a very positive thing. It's open-minded. And being closed-minded is a very, very negative thing. These words mean nothing. We have certain words that have become negatives or positives, and they really, if you think into them, are not negative or positive. They are very much dependent on what you're talking about. Old-fashioned, up until a few years ago, old-fashioned was a negative. Something was old-fashioned definitely wasn't good. But think for a second. Breathing is very old-fashioned. People have been doing it for a long, long time. Nobody does it differently. But we all do it the old-fashioned way of breathing. And yet, it's pretty good to breathe, right? Nobody has given up breathing because it's old-fashioned. So not everything that's old-fashioned is bad, and not everything that's new-fashioned is good. When I was in high school, they came up with a new mishigas, just for me. I had enough trouble with the math that was normal, but they decided that the old math was no good. They had to have a new math. Came in a yellow, soft-covered book, right? Couldn't even be a regular textbook. That was old-fashioned, to have textbooks with hard covers. Had to have a soft cover, yellow cover, things that nobody ever heard of. The teacher didn't know what she was teaching. She had no idea, but she had to teach it. We had no idea. She had no idea. Sets and who knows what, things that a person would never use in their life. And then they realized that was new. The new math made it for sure good. After a few years of this, when they saw nobody was learning any of this, and it meant nothing, and it was useless, so they had to go back, but they couldn't go back to the old math, chas v'shalom, old-fashioned math. So what they did is they created a new math, which happened to be the old-fashioned math, back again, but in a new package. So certain words get negative or positive connotations, and really they have no negative or positive. One of those words is closed-minded or open-minded. It's good to be open-minded, I'll tell you. Sometimes people are so open-minded their brains fall out. So it's not very good, right? But I want my child to know what there is in the world. Fine. Send him for a month to live amongst cannibals. He should know what it's like to eat another human being. Oh, no, but that's too much. So where is not too much? So it's not good to be open-minded without qualification. You have to qualify it. So where do you draw the line? There is a line of what you want your children to know or not. So now it's only a question of where the line is. It's not a question that open-minded is always good and closed-minded is always bad. So if a child does not have to be exposed, in his entire life will never be exposed to some negative influence, then the best thing is to shield him and shelter him and not expose him to it. Especially little children. Even if a child will grow up living in the world that we live in, there's not too much that he won't come in contact with. So he is by necessity going to be exposed. By fact of nature is going to be exposed to most of the things. He doesn't have to be exposed to them when he's 2 years old or 3 years old. It's extremely important that the foundation, the Gemara says, I said before, the world exists on the babble of little children, the Torah learning of little children. So the Maharal Mikrag explains what's so special about little children learning Torah. Why is that what keeps the world going? Because that is the foundation and root of all Torah. And the foundation and the root have to be a lot stronger and a lot better than the plant or the building that's built on that foundation or comes from that root. If there's the slightest blemish in a root, it'll come out a thousandfold in the plant itself. If there's a slight hairline crack in the foundation, then it endangers the entire building. That same crack on the third floor would have no effect, would not be detrimental. But in the foundation of the building, a hairline crack is detrimental. So when you're dealing with the foundation and the root of a child's education, even those things that a child will inevitably be exposed to, but he doesn't have to be exposed to them when he's 2 years old. You can wait. Let him get a foundation. Some say the Chanoch Lenar Al Pi Darko. I think the Al-Sheikh says it. Teach a child Al Pi Darko is normally explained according to his way. Individualistic education. But the Al-Sheikh says it means something else. Chanoch Lenar Al Pi Darko means train your child before he gets his own way, which may be crooked and blemished. Train him the right way before you have to train him how to get away from the wrong way. It's much easier to set the foundation and the root properly than to correct it later on after something's become distorted. So when you are laying the foundation and the root of this child's education, there it is crucial that when he doesn't have to be exposed to, he's not exposed to. So at least his foundation and his root is pure. Later on, if he's going to have to be exposed to negative things, then you can try to shelter him, insulate him as much as possible, even if you can't isolate him. But let it happen later. Let it not be in the first formative years of life where it's possible to shelter and shield a child from negative influences. But again, where that's not possible, and certainly for an older child in the society we live in almost world over, there is no place, no place, I don't care if it's Square Town or Mea Shearim, that one can grow up isolated from the influences around. It's almost impossible today. I pretty much think it is impossible. And therefore, there is a benefit of exposing a child to things in the right way, from the right perspective, and not letting him discover them on his own, thinking that you can shield him and isolate him and he'll never have to come in contact with these things. What's the mile? There's a famous Maimer Chazal which is usually learned different than I'm going to tell you, but I think that it also has the following meaning. The Mokum Shabali Tshuva Omdim Afilu Tzadik Gomer Eino Yochol Amud. In a place where a Baal Tshuva, someone who has seen the other side of life and has rejected it, and repented, returned to a Torah way of life, where that person stands, even as a person who has been from his entire life, can't stand. Normally we understand that to mean that a Baal Tshuva is superior to a Tzaddik who's a Tzaddik from birth. Here is somebody who's seen the other way, rejected it. He has come to a point that's higher than the person who has been like that his entire life. And there is truth to that too, for sure. But I think it can be understood on a much more literal way. Sometimes a person who has seen the other side and been exposed to it and taught to reject it can stand in places, literally, that a person who's never been exposed to those things can't literally stand. It would be a danger for that person to be exposed to such an environment. You take a person who has seen and rejected those negatives, no harm will come to him if he is put back into that environment. But take someone who's never seen that environment, that negative environment, and put him in that environment, it'll devastate him. Then the danger is there. It's like a person who's been vaccinated, inoculated. If you've had the disease mildly, and your body has rejected it, that immunizes you from getting it again. But if your body has never rejected the disease, you've never been exposed to it, then being exposed to it is very, very dangerous. So in one respect, if you expose your child to things that are by necessity he's going to be exposed to no matter what, then exposing him in a positive way with the right understanding from a Torah standpoint of why it's wrong will give him a lot more strength than letting him be exposed to it later on and not preparing him, not inoculating him, not vaccinating him. On the other hand, the opposite is also true. There is a positive about people who are sheltered, who are not exposed. There's a certain sensitivity that we mentioned before, that people who have not been exposed to negatives, give you an example. I grew up in Miami. In Miami, the time when I grew up there, you couldn't find a handful of Shomer Shabbos people. If you saw somebody with Shomer Shabbos, you went over to them, shook their hand, wow, something special. A Jew that wasn't Shomer Shabbos was the status quo. That was understandable. That was normal. Right? We didn't see people dressed like me in Miami for sure. And if you did, you knew they were there for one purpose. I didn't have to mention what it was. So I once went into the big world, left Miami, went to yeshiva, and came to New York. And in New York, I see this frum person, right, dressed, you know, like a real chassidish, yeshivish person, and he sticks out his hand. I shook it. I thought, you know, here's a guy, he sees another frum yid, you know, it's he looked at me like I was out of my mind, and the friends who were with me from New York couldn't stop laughing. This is the first time everybody ever shook this guy's hand when he stuck out his hand for obviously a different purpose. But for me, he's a landsman, another frum yid. When you grow up in a situation like that, you can't understand, coming to Eretz Yisrael, why a yid from Mei Yeshorim sees another Jew driving on Shabbos and starts screaming, Shabbos! It's a big deal, right? If I see Jews not driving on Shabbos, it's something to scream about. But what's the big deal about screaming about a Jew driving on Shabbos? See it all the time, but they don't see it all the time. And they're sensitive to Chilul Shabbos. It's the same thing as us seeing somebody barbecuing his child to Molech. We scream also. If you get used to it, and it becomes status quo, it becomes habitual, then you lose the sensitivity. Just understand people who are sensitized still. It says that when Esav's wives made their sacrifices to idolatry, their incense to idolatry, it blinded Yitzchak Avinu. That's why he was blind. But Rivka Imenu wasn't blinded. On the one hand, it's a positive. Like we said, she could exist in that environment because she grew up in that environment. And it didn't affect her. It didn't blind her. On the other hand, it's a negative. She wasn't sensitive to it. It didn't blind her because she was not sensitive. So there is a positive of exposing your child and immunizing them to things that they will have to be exposed to, but there's also a positive of shielding them as much as possible from things that they won't have to be exposed to, that they can maintain their sensitivity to what Torah values are. How do you create this insulation? Let's see what time I'm supposed to finish here. Because I really want to see this film. Okay. I never tried to compete with dessert or films. And here they put me up against both of them, so I will finish to the minute, the lean nether, that I am supposed to finish. There's a medrash that says the following. L'mishpichoseihem yotzu min ha-teva. That when they left Noah's ark, they left family by family. And the medrash says, Mikan sheyotzim mibeis ha-kneses mishpachos mishpachos. When you leave shul, you should leave family by family. We don't have families that pray together, stay together, because our families don't pray together. The women daven on their side, the men on their side. But at least when you leave the shul, you should leave family by family. What's the simple meaning of the medrash? The word teva means the ark, Noah's ark. But the teva in the time of the Mishnah referred to the Aron HaKodesh. What we call an Aron Kodesh was called a Teva. So it's a play on words. L'mishpichoseyim yotzu min ha-teva. When they left the Teva, they left family by family. So too, when they leave the Teva, the Aron Kodesh, and in English, there's a vestige of that. Because in English, we call the Aron Kodesh the Holy Ark. Same ark as Noah's Ark. What's the deeper meaning? In this world, you need to be insulated. The waters, the flood waters surround us. Just like the physical flood waters surrounded Noah. What protected him from those waters? He couldn't escape them. The whole world was flooded. The whole world was inundated with those evil waters, those destructive waters. What you needed was a tight ship that could withstand and insulate those waters penetrating its shell. That's what you need, insulation. What are the tevas that protect us from the spiritual waters of negative influences? They are bate knesios, bate medrashos, shuls, communities built around shuls, yeshivas. Those are the tevas. Those are the arcs, the spiritual arcs, where you create a bubble amongst a very hostile secular world, where your community and your focus is on the ideas and the ideals that are promulgated in those four walls of a yeshiva, of a shul. But you can't live in a yeshiva and a shul your whole life. You have to sometimes leave it. How can you leave it and not be inundated by the floodwaters? L'mishpichoseihem yotzu min ha-teva. If you leave with strong families, if your families adopt the same standards and values that the shul and the yeshiva represent, then you can leave the shul and the yeshiva and still be protected because your family protects you. That's what it means. You can leave the teva in one way if you leave with your family, if you have a strong family. What are these shuls, yeshivas, and families supposed to create that creates the insulation? How do you build a waterproof boat? The main thing is not the education to what to do, what there is to do to observe in Torah. There's something much more than just keeping mitzvahs. Yaakov Avinu tells Esav, "Im lavan garti, I live with Lavan, the tarried mitzvah shamarti, and I kept 613 mitzvahs, the lo lamadati mi maisav haroim, and I didn't learn from his evil ways." It seems to imply that you can keep all 613 mitzvahs and still not be able to say that you didn't learn from Lavan's evil ways. How could you keep all 613 mitzvahs and not still have learned from Lavan's evil ways? Because more important than just keeping mitzvahs is having the right standards and values and outlook and lifestyle. And it's possible for a person to have a secular lifestyle with secular values and secular goals and secular ideals and yet to keep the mitzvahs. But the foundation is missing. And if all you educate your children to do is to keep a bunch of commands, then you've missed the boat, literally. Literally. There's more of creating a Torah way of life with the right ideals and the right ideas to the point where there is a contradiction between something that the Vilna Gaon said and something the Dubna Maggid said. And the Dubna Maggid and the Vilna Gaon were contemporary. The Vilna Gaon was a Talmud, the Dubna Maggid was a Talmud Chaver of the Vilna Gaon. He was a contemporary, a student in his learning. But the Vilna Gaon used to call on the Dubna Maggid to give him mussar. Or so goes the story. I have to ask Rabbi Wein later if that's historically true. But in any case, that's the way the story goes. So it's very hard to believe that these two individuals had such diverse philosophies of Judaism. In one place, the Vilna Gaon says that if a mitzvah comes too easily, it's a sign that it's not really a good mitzvah, that you're not doing it the proper way. Because mitzvahs have to come with difficulty. The Satan wouldn't let you do a mitzvah easily. And the Dubna Maggid says just the opposite. That if mitzvahs are too difficult, it's a sign you're not doing it God's way. Because God said, I gave you easy mitzvahs. I made mitzvahs tailor-made to what Jews can do. So if a mitzvah is too hard, it must be it's not my mitzvah. Now those two things can't be compatible together. The Vilna Gaon says if it's too easy, it's not the right mitzvah. And the Dubna Maggid says if it's too hard, it's not the right mitzvah. So which is it? I was thinking there's two levels. There's the level of creating the proper outlook, ideals, ideas, way of life. And that's very difficult. If that comes too easy, something's wrong. It's very difficult to get a Torah perspective on life and to inculcate within yourself and your children the right ideals and the right ideas. That's very difficult. But if you do that, then keeping the mitzvahs is a cinch. If you don't do that, and as I heard once Rabbi Hollander say, someone whose ideas, ideals, way of life is a secular way of life, but he wants to be frum, he wants to keep 613 commandments, he doesn't have 613 mitzvahs. He has 613 problems. Because every mitzvah is another problem. Every mitzvah contradicts and conflicts with his way of life, with his ideas, ideals, and goals. First, you have to set the base for Torah and mitzvahs. The ideas, the ideals, the goals. And then you can build on that a Torah way of life. Let me give you an example of how foreign ideas and ideals creep in to our society. And that's the major waterproofing that the boat needs to make living in such a society possible. Give me something light and perhaps absurd, and then I'll go to something a little bit heavier. When I was a rabbi in Miami, in my community in North Miami Beach, as opposed to Rabbi Wein's community in Miami Beach, we did not have a mikveh. The nearest mikveh was 30 minutes away by car. We didn't have a yeshiva, a day school, everything was in Miami Beach. It was a community just growing in its baby stage. We didn't have a yeshiva or a mikveh. One day, one of my balabatim, a fine Shomer Shabbos person, comes to me, very upset. He says, Rabbi, I must speak to you immediately. I take him to my office. He says, I'm very upset. I've been thinking about this for days. There is one thing that our community is missing for it to be a top-notch Torah community. So my eyes lit up. Here's a guy who's really upset that we don't have a mikveh in the community, that we don't have a yeshiva in the community. And I anxiously said to him, okay, what is that one thing that this community is missing that would make it a top-notch Torah community? And as soon as he would tell me either mikveh or yeshiva, I would say, fine, if it really upsets you, then why don't you become the chairman of the mikveh committee or the yeshiva committee, and let's build a mikveh, let's build a yeshiva. If it really upsets you, do something about it. So with great anticipation, I said to him, Nu, tell me, what is that one thing that would make our community a top-notch Torah community? And he said, a glatt kosher French restaurant. I promise you. After I regained consciousness, trying to figure out where I'm going to put the mikveh in this restaurant, I realized, what was the problem here? Don't get me wrong. I have nothing against French restaurants, glatt kosher ones for sure. That is a very big plus, French, Chinese, Italian, whatever it may be, for any community. Right, my expertise in French cuisine ends with French fries, but I'm sure there's more to it. So, that's not the problem. The problem is, what in the world does that have to do with being a top-notch Torah community? I would understand if you told me it'd be a top-notch French community, culinary community, restaurant community, but what in the world does that have to do with Torah? I must have missed that shear in Tells when they gave the shear on French restaurants. Definitely be a plus in the community, but that's what makes a Torah community. So a person has standards and values that are secular and looks at the Torah through those eyes. And that becomes glatt kosher. So you can be a glatt kosher goy too. But the Rebbe wants us to be glatt kosher Jews, not glatt kosher goy. So it's extremely important that one first formulate his ideas and ideals and standards and values and goals, and make them Torah, and then the 613 mitzvahs are a cinch, because based on those ideas and ideals and goals, that's what the mitzvahs were meant to be based upon. One other example, which is a more serious one. You are all aware, I'm sure, that there are women today who feel shortchanged, discriminated against. Somehow God has it in for them, and didn't give them the ability to express their spirituality at least publicly, they can't get an aliyah, they can't be the chazan, they can't put on tefillin, they can't sing out their kishkes in front of the Kosel HaMaravi on Rosh Chodesh, and they feel shortchanged. And I don't mean to minimize the problem. It's a problem. It's a problem. People should realize, though, that if they really believe in the Torah, they only have one place to complain. That's by the boss. Right? Don't complain against the rabbis. They didn't do it. Right? The Rabbanu Shlom did it. So you have a complaint. See the boss. But why, all of a sudden, in this generation, do women have this feeling? Why not three generations ago? Why not? Why the Chazon Ish's mother didn't feel shortchanged? Why didn't she feel that she just can't express her spirituality? So what will you tell me? Well, the Chazon Ish's mother was satisfied to stay in the kitchen and bake chocolate cakes. She wasn't a very spiritual person, but today's women are so spiritually inclined that this is important to them. I can't swallow that. If you ever read a biography of the Chazon Ish and realize that his mother probably was the greatest cause of him becoming the Chazon Ish, she was a very spiritually inclined woman. So why didn't it bother her? Why didn't she ever complain about it? I'll tell you what I think. One factor. There are a myriad of factors, but I believe that this is one of many factors and a very important one. If you would tap someone on the shoulder, a guy in the street, and ask him, I want to give you one of two positions. I can wave a magic wand, and I can give you one of two positions in life. You could either be a movie star. Everybody will know you. Your face will be a common household occurrence. Your name will be a household word. You'll be famous. You'll make X amount of money. Or I can wave my magic wand, but you won't be too talented. You'll be a movie star. That's about it. Or I can wave my magic wand and make you a very talented person who will make the scenery, direct the movies. You won't be the star. You'll be behind the scenes. Your name will appear at the end in small letters that nobody ever reads. You'll make the same amount of money. You'll have a lot more talent, but you won't be famous. What do you think the secular person in the street will choose? Almost 99% of the time, fame. Because from a secular standpoint, fame is a value to itself, to the point where I was in Cleveland, there was once a murder that puzzled the police. A man murdered his neighbor he didn't even know. Just opened the door one day and shot him dead. When they finally investigated why, what was the motive? He said, I'll tell you the truth, I wanted to be famous. I wanted my name in the front page of the paper, and the only way I could do it is by killing somebody. So this guy lived across the hall, was the nearest person to kill. Fame is a value. From a Torah standpoint, fame is not necessarily a value. It's not wrong to be famous if it serves a purpose. But it's not a value in itself, just the opposite. The value in itself is as more as you can be. In the background, the better it is. The most holy place in the world was the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh HaKadoshim. I guarantee you there never was a spread in Better Homes and Gardens on the decor of the Holy of Holies. It was hidden, nobody ever saw it, the Kohen Gadol didn't even see it, it was in a smoke screen once a year on Yom Kippur. And that was the holiest place, that which is hidden behind the scenes is more holy. If someone has a Torah outlook on life, he's been brought up, it's in his bones, that which is hidden, that which is behind the scenes is more positive. How can you complain about having a role that puts you behind the scenes? If anything, men should complain. How come I'm thrust into the limelight? But if you're brought up in a society where the value is being in the limelight, then how can you not feel shortchanged if you're pushed into the background? But it's not because the Torah discriminates, because from a Torah standpoint, the value is what is positive, is what you're complaining about. But why are you complaining about it? Because your values and standards are not Torah values and standards. That is one factor, not the only one, but it's one factor. And therefore, the major insulation is not so much seeing to it that you educate your children, tell them what to do, but to give them the right standards and values and lifestyle so they can insulate themselves and know that if they have to go out into the world and be exposed to other things, that's not my lifestyle. That's not my values. That's not my standards. And that makes it easier for them to return to that teva, which is the shul or the yeshiva or the family, and be insulated very strongly from those negative waters around. Just to sum up, therefore I think that the title should have been not raising a child in a secular world, isolation, insulation, or exposure, but in fact we have to sometimes expose our children to the things of the outside world in the right way, in the proper way, because they're going to be exposed inevitably, and better they should be exposed in the way that we tell them how to look at what they're going to be exposed to. Sometimes we should shield and isolate our children from negative influences. And sometimes we should insulate them. On the one hand, not isolate them. On the other hand, not totally expose them either. And for that, you need a lot of wisdom and a lot of advice. And you have to be very, very sensitive. And I'll end just with this point to think about. It's not always so simple to know when to isolate, when to insulate, and when to expose. And what to isolate and insulate a child from. Because certain things seem very benign, very harmless. And in fact, in other situations, may be harmless. But in the time and place where you live, those things can be very, very dangerous. Before we left Egypt, HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded us to take gold and silver from the Egyptians and also Egyptian clothing and to put it on our children. Very strange mitzvah. The rabbis tell us that one of the merits that we had to be able to be redeemed was that we didn't change our mode of clothing, that we did not wear Egyptian clothing the 210 years we were in Egypt. And now we're going out of Egypt and God says, take the Egyptian clothing, put it on your kids. What kind of influence is that? What kind of exposure is that? What's the purpose of it? I was thinking that God wanted to teach us the following lesson. That in fact there is nothing intrinsically wrong with Egyptian clothing. The proof, I want you to wear it when you go out of Egypt. I want you to put it on your children. If there'd be something intrinsically wrong, it wouldn't be modest. It would be shatnez. Something would be wrong with it intrinsically. You couldn't wear it. You couldn't put it on your children. So I wanted you to know there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that clothing. Had you worn that clothing, though, the last 210 years in Egypt, you never would have gone out. How could that be? Either it's okay or it's not okay. The answer is that in the desert, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that clothing. But had you worn it in Egypt to be like the Egyptian, that's wrong. And there are many things like that. Just one example, and then I will turn over the podium to Rabbi Wein, if anybody has any questions. One example, again, from my growing up in Miami. When I was in high school, the Beatles were the rage. Sure, most of you have heard about the Beatles. You have not been isolated to the point where you've never heard of the Beatles or think that they're little cockroaches that... they were little cockroaches. But in any case, the Beatles brought the fad to the world of men having long hair. Okay? It started a little bit with the hippies, but that wasn't really accepted. But the fad, the fashion, fashionable long hair for men was a product of the Beatles. And it didn't, we were in Miami, even though we were very isolated and insulated from the secular world, but somehow it crept in. And there were a few guys in my class, right, who had heard about the Beatles somehow. I don't know how exactly, living in Miami Beach, how they heard about the Beatles, but they did hear about them. And they stopped cutting their hair. And within a month or two, the place started looking like a co-ed high school. And the Rosh Yeshiva, the Mesifta, called these boys in, and it wasn't me. I never had any predilection for long hair, as you can see. They called them in, and they said to them, listen, either you get a haircut today, or you're being suspended and perhaps thrown out of this school. You can't stay here. So these boys, very innocently, said to the Rebbein, but what's wrong with long hair? A Nazir has long hair. He's a holy man. Right, a Nazirite lets his hair grow. He's not allowed to cut his hair. We want to be holy like a Nazir. You ever see the Ragachover? Ragachover gone? Right? He had hair coming from all ends. We just want to be like the Ragachover. What could be wrong with long hair? The answer is perhaps nothing is wrong with long hair. If you're the Ragachover and you have long hair, if you're a Nazir and you have long hair, intrinsically there could be nothing wrong with it. But if you have long hair because you want to be like the Beatles, that's what's wrong. So it's not always so clear what you have to insulate, isolate your children from, Because in one situation, in one place, in one time, the thing may be innocuous. And in another place, in another time, it may be a symbol of something so negative that that destroys the boat and sinks it. So a person has to be very, very sensitive and very wise and follow the advice of Torah sages to know how to create that boat that is the family, that's the yeshiva, that's the shul, that ultimately will keep out the floodwaters and create an environment where children can flourish and grow into Torah productive adults and bring up their own families within their own tevas. And in that way, in that schus, the Rabbanu Shalom will take us out of the floodwaters altogether and bring us back to the ultimate teva, which is Eretz Yisrael, the Vias Goel Tzedek and Heirav Yameinu.
About 10 minutes for questions or comments, and then we're going to go downstairs for the dessert reception and for the Spanish trip reunion. Any comments or questions? Don't be embarrassed. Yes. Go ahead. Thank you.
That's an excellent question. Let me portray to you an absurd situation, okay, that will give a little bit of a preface to the answer I want to give you. We are enjoined, like I said, to always strive to live with people who will be a good influence on us and to stay away from people who will be a negative influence on us. Okay, that means that I should want to live with people who are on a higher level than I am, Torah observance, Torah knowledge, and so on. At the same time, why in the world would those people want to live with me? I am a negative influence on them. So I will be running after them, and they're running after the people who are better than them, who are running away from them because they're lower than them. And you end up with a Keystone Cop chase where everybody's chasing everybody else till the last guy's chasing the first guy. So how does this work in a real world? How do you strive to live with people who are better than you at the same time they don't want to live with you because they're striving to live with people better than them? And how does anybody ever have a positive effect on anyone that they could bring closer to Judaism if you're supposed to stay away from situations like that? The answer is that obviously is not what is meant. Since a person can't avoid situations where he comes in contact with people both on a higher level and a lower level than himself, what a person has to do is, again, know where I am and what I am, and be educated very strongly what my standards are, what my values are, and to know that people around them, especially if they're of a similar nature, some people have strengths in one area, some people have weaknesses in another area. And I look at the strengths of the people around me and aspire to that. And they look at the strengths that I have, and I understand what I am, then it is a very positive situation to deal with people who perhaps are on a lower level with the intent of bringing them closer, bringing them higher. But again, if you're dealing with children who don't know yet who they are and what they are, and are very much drawn and enticed by the things they see out there in the world, and to them they are positive values when they should be negative values, and they haven't yet been inculcated, then you are putting your child in a very dangerous situation. So you as a parent have to know how much your child is insulated and knows who they are and what they are, and how much their intention is not that this is the environment I'd love to be in, but what can I do? My parents won't let me. Or this is the environment that I really don't want to be in. I'm very happy and proud to be the environment that I come from, and I will reach out from my environment and try to bring others into that bubble, into that environment that I have. If you have a child who can function the second way, then matovu manoim. Then the best thing is send them to the birthday party and let them be a good example to others. But if the child is on the border, and surely the other way, then sending that child to that secular birthday party is endangering them, because you are putting in front of them that which you tell them they shouldn't have and can't have and shouldn't want, and yet they see it so alluring and so enticing. So there's no one generic answer. The answer is that you have to know the situation, know the child, know yourself, and in certain situations the ideal would be to reach out from your bubble and put out a life raft to someone else, and the other situation is stay on board because you may drown.
I'd only like to add that when I was growing up in Chicago, so there were about 100 boys on our block on the west side, I was the only Shomer Shabbos child on the block because my parents wouldn't allow it any other way. And I had absolutely no influence on anyone else, a trait I've noticed later in life as well. But I had absolutely no influence. Nobody wanted to be a Shomer Shabbos, and nobody became a Shomer Shabbos. They would come every Shabbos, knock on the door and say, you know, can he come out to play, or we're going to the ball game, or we're going to a movie. And on the other hand, when my children were growing up in Chicago, they were very small. I was active, my wife and I, we were active in a day school that was just developing. Now it's a very, very large school, thank God. And in that school, there was one Hasidic family, the children of a Rebbe, the only Rebbe in Chicago then, or the active Rebbe in Chicago then. And so his sons came to school with payas. His daughters came, they wore tights even in the hottest spring June days. And the rest of the school were, you know, everyone else was modern American. And after a period of time, everybody came home and they said, you know, why can't I have payas? Or why don't I dress with tights? Because those children were so imbued with the fact that they were right and that those were the standards, that they, to a great extent, influenced and imposed their will upon the other students. And I thought about that, that the comparison between my generation and my children's generation. Firstly, it's a different generation, right? I grew up in a generation where everybody was running away. And today's generation has got a lot of cross currents with it. There are a lot of people looking to come back. They don't know how to come back, and they don't have people to help them come back. None of the answers are that simple. But I think Rabbi Leff's point is probably the basic point. That is, what does the child think of himself or herself? Does the child feel deprived, put upon? I'm doing it for my parents. I have no pride in what I'm doing. So then that's one thing. The child feels, look how fortunate I am, and how proud I am, and how strong I am. So then that's another thing. The last point that I like to make, there's a famous story that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter sent his disciple, Rabbi Yitzchak Blaser, to St. Petersburg to become the Rav in St. Petersburg. St. Petersburg then had almost no Orthodox Jewish community. They were all assimilated Jews. So he told him, Rebbe, I'm afraid to go. So Rabbi Yisrael said, whom shall I send? Someone who is not afraid? So there's that element that's involved here, too. If you want to do something for the Jewish people, you're at risk. Now, everybody has to measure their risks, and everybody has to be able to adjust and see what's involved, etc. Not everybody can live in the safe, so to speak, enclaves, of which there are none anymore. These are all judgment questions, and that's what makes being a parent such a wonderful job. And the difficulties that are involved, but I think Rabbi Leff has pointed out the situation very well. One more question. The dessert is melting. Any more questions, comments? I'd really like to thank Rabbi Leff for getting us off on such a wonderful start. And giving us all food for thought, and he'll be available if you want to talk to him privately. I understand that most of the time people don't want to talk about these things publicly, but that there are a lot of ideas and questions and cut there. So if we'll all go downstairs and in the terrace restaurant, there's a dessert, and in the Palm Court area. I mean, I have no idea where these places are, but if, but they must exist. And there we're going to have a small reunion from our Spanish trip, and then we'll be showing the movie at about approximately 10 o'clock downstairs in the room where we ate supper. Thanks.